The Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this unrehearsed news conference, ready to talk with General E.P. Quesada, administrator of the Federal Aviation Agency. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
The Federal Aviation Agency came into existence following a tragic series of mid-air collisions. The man given the power to administer the law is General E.R. Quesada, who is our guest today. Once again, the problem of safety in the air has come to the forefront with the recent disaster over New York City, which was the worst in our aviation history. General Quesada's interest in aviation dates back to 1924, when he enlisted as a flying cadet. In 1929, he was a member of a crew which established an endurance record of 150 hours in the air. When he retired in 1951, General Quesada held the rank of three-star general. He has now resigned from his present position, and he will become the president of the new Washington baseball team. We'll start the questions today with Mr. Spivak.
General, do you know yet what caused the crash between TWA and United, which took 134 lives about 2 weeks ago?
No, sir, Mr. Spivak. We do not know what caused the tragedy to occur. The determination of probable cause is the responsibility of the Civil Aeronautics Board.
Do you yourself think you're ever going to know?
I do. Yes, we do.
Have you taken any new steps recently to prevent the repetition of a disaster like that?
Well, we've been taking steps for many years to prevent disasters like this. It was tragic, and it's incumbent upon the government to do everything it can to prevent them. But I must say that we've been very, very active in trying to prevent just such occurrences.
But have you taken any new steps in the last 2 weeks? Can the public be given any assurance at all that something of the same kind may not be happening right now in the crowded skies over New York?
It can't be given any assurance that it will not happen. But you can be sure that we are doing everything in our power to prevent it from occurring. There isn't anything that has occurred in this accident or has been brought out to date that would suggest that what we are now doing is completely inadequate. Obviously, it is not foolproof.
In short, you're proceeding now over New York exactly the way you did before the accident happened.
Substantially, yes. We have checked all the facilities for their accuracy. We have found nothing wrong with the facilities. We are reviewing our procedures, and we find that, as far as we can determine, we have found nothing wrong with the procedures.
In short, you're now operating, you think, under rules and regulations and under procedures, which are as good as we can expect at the present time. To prevent crashes.
That is so.
Mr. Hannafin.
Mr. Quesada, a very great aviator, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, once said that one of the prices that human beings must pay for movement is an occasional stub toe. Given the fact that airways and equipment are not foolproof or human-proof, there are nevertheless various alternatives which are available at Idlewild and at other facilities around the country which are at the pilot's command. In this specific case of the jet and the Connie crash over Millard Field, the pilot of the United jet had reported on his company radio that his facility, one of his Omni facilities, one of his radios was out. What other facilities, alternate facilities, standby facilities were available to this man in this emergency or semi-emergency?
Well, there were many facilities available to him. First, let me clarify one point. He didn't report that his Omni was out. He reported that a panel was out, and we are assuming that if that panel is out, then one of his Omnis is out. He reported this to his company frequency, on his company frequency, and not to us. So we are assuming that an Omni was out. He has another Omni in his aeroplane that he could have used. And in a DC-8, he is unusually equipped. he could not only have used his Omni, but he also has another instrument that can do all that an Omni can do that normally is not used for an Omni. But more importantly, he could have told us that he was having navigation trouble, and we could have given him aid over and above that which he was getting. By a strange coincidence, Mr. Hannafin, at that very moment, in fact, 3 seconds, or somewhere between 7 and 3 seconds, after the collision occurred, a Pan American DC of 707 landed at Idlewild, having experienced somewhat similar trouble. He lost a part of his airborne navigation equipment, and he told us so and asked us to lead him by the hand into the airport. And we did so, and were in fact doing it while this accident occurred. A strange coincidence.
The same facility would have been available to the United Jet.
The same facility would have been available to United Jet, and it is common practice that occurs day in and day out, over and over and over, for this to occur. The system is a cooperative system. The responsibility for navigation rests in the hands of the pilot. It is his and his alone. We provide facilities to permit him to navigate. When he is in difficulty, we will come to his aid and comfort. And we do this over and over again. He could lose both Omnis and we could get him down.
Mr. Hackus.
General, are you saying in general that this accident was the result of pilot error? Isn't it a little bit too early to come to that conclusion?
I'm not saying that it was pilot error. You are.
Well, isn't this the indication, the burden of your statement so far?
Well, I'm not making that statement. If you wish to interpret it that way, you may, but I'm not.
Well, you're saying that the pilot could have been talked in on another frequency or in another way when his Omni was not functioning correctly.
Yes, he could have.
Isn't it possible that someone on the ground, one of your FAA people, might have reminded him of that or come in on some other frequency or done something else?
We had no knowledge whatsoever to the effect that he had lost any of his normal navigation ability. Had no knowledge whatsoever.
My question is this, then, if I can broaden it a little. This is the first accident, or perhaps the first serious accident, under your so-called positive control system from the ground. Doesn't it seem that, regardless of who was at fault, that there may be some serious inadequacies in the system, at least at this point?
Oh, I don't doubt, but there might be, it might be proven the inadequacies in the system. But they haven't been proven yet. However, they might be. This is the responsibility of the board. However, to get back specifically to your question, we must not assume at all times something is wrong with the airborne equipment within the airplane that is at the disposal of the pilot to navigate. And this is what you are suggesting.
Well, you made a statement some time ago, shortly after the accident, I believe after you talked with the president, that the plane was 11 miles from where it should have been.
That's quite obvious.
And I think we'll both agree that that's obvious. But the impression that was made by your statement, even though you didn't say those words, was that the pilot was at fault. You can say, I saw so-and-so last week and he was sober. He may be sober all the time, but the indication is, well, you know, he was sober, but he might have been drunk. You see my point. The implication, I think, to some people in this country who didn't know the precise words that you used was that it was a pilot error, and that's what you were saying.
Well, let me make it clear. I made known certain facts over which there can be no dispute. One of those facts is that the collision took place practically over Miller Field on Staten Island. That's fact number one. Fact number two, over which there can be no dispute, the limit of the pilot's clearance was the Preston holding pattern. And the Preston holding pattern was some 11 miles short of where the collision occurred.
Mr. Wilson.
I just want to clear up one point in this respect. Do I understand you to state categorically that the United plane, the jet plane, had some navigational failure which caused it to be 11 miles off its course. You know that to be a fact.
No. As I indicated to Mr. Hannafin, we have found out that the pilot reported the loss of one of his electrical panels.
Yeah.
And if he loses that electrical panel, it is prima facie that he has lost one of his omnis. And that it is on that basis that we assume he only had one omni left.
What is an omni?
An omni is an electrical device that will permit you to point at one of our navigation aids, or you can set it so it will tell you when you are on a particular bearing from that aid. You have your choice.
And you assume he lost the service of that navigation?
Of one of them.
Of one of them.
That's right.
Oh. Now, Mr. General Quesada, I have read some of your recent writings, and I tend to conclude from them that you think both the Airline Pilots Association and the airline owners themselves are standing in the way of maximum safety procedures in the air. Is that an erroneous conclusion from what you have written?
I don't think it's too erroneous, no. I think they have resisted some of the safety measures that we have attempted to take and are taking. This is a matter of public record.
Yes. Is this on a broad enough scale to have a serious significance to airline passengers?
No, sir, because we don't let the resistance become that effective.
You overcome the resistance?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, it leads me to ask a question. Is it possible to operate an airline profitably with the maximum safety procedures involved?
Well, this is a very good question, Mr. Wilson, and you've got to draw this narrow line. We try not to get into too deeply to the economic implications of running an airline. It would be clear that if the measures or by the process of rules that we imposed on an airline were unreasonable and made it impossible for them to operate, then we would be arbitrary and capricious. We have to be reasonable in the application of our rules. And when we're not, the courts will strike us down.
In other words, they are entitled to operate under the law and under your interpretation, whether it's dangerous or not.
They are required by the law to operate with the highest possible standard of safety. They are the words in the law. They operate the airlines, we don't. And under the law, they are required to operate with the highest possible standard of safety. We give them a certificate to operate, and we impose standards upon them. And they must operate within the framework of these standards.
But both the pilots and the owners are standing in the way of the maximum safety requirements in the air.
I'll go back to what I said before. They have opposed some of the safety measures that we have adopted, and this is in the docket.
Mr. Spivak.
General, would you say that the airports of the nation have kept pace with the growth of commercial aviation?
I would say they have not, Mr. Spivak. The airports of the nation are well behind the need, and the needs of commercial aviation are progressing so rapidly that the communities are having a hard time keeping up, and the airports are not as good as they should be.
Well, now, where do you place the responsibility for that?
On the communities.
What about the FAA, of which you're administrator?
The responsibility of constructing and operating airports is the responsibility of the communities and not ours.
But the responsibility for safety is yours, is that not so?
And when any airport that any community builds is unsafe, we don't let aircraft go into it.
Well, do you think that the airports today are as safe as they ought to be?
They're not as safe as they ought to be, and they're not as they don't have the capacity to accept the traffic as fast as they could.
Well, if they don't, then they are not as safe as they ought to be, and isn't that your responsibility?
No, it is not my responsibility to build an airport safe for San Francisco. It's San Francisco's responsibility to do so.
But if it's dangerous to come into the airport at San Francisco, oughtn't you do something about that airport?
If it were dangerous, we would. And do.
If it were risky, would you?
Risky depends on the degree of risk.
I've heard pilots tell me, and they've told many other people, that the air traffic over New York is a real serious risk. That those airports are so crowded that particularly in bad weather, you take your life in your hands when you travel in one of those planes. Now, is that dangerous or isn't it?
Well, first I'll say it's an overstatement because we don't let the traffic in New York get to a point where it is inherently dangerous. This is when the public is imposed with these delays, such as stacking and things like this. This is our method of preventing this dangerous condition from occurring. If we could let the traffic flow uninterrupted, it would be dangerous. And it is because the airports are inadequate that we do not permit the traffic to flow uninterrupted.
General, 2 years ago, when I think before you took office, you were quoted as saying that control of modern air traffic will be impossible without a semi-automatic system using computers and other devices already in use for business and for weapons. Now, do all of our airports have those computers now?
No, sir, they do not.
Why haven't they?
Because they haven't been developed.
No, but you said they were developed for business and for other weapons. They already...
They have not been applied to this purpose, and it is no easy task to do so. We are spending about $75 million a year in research and development to develop this semi-automatic system. Now, when I say the computers, it is the technique that is developed, but the actual machinery and equipment is not developed and is very rapidly being developed, and one will be in being in 1962 in the area of Baltimore.
But at that time, in criticism, I think, of what was going on, you said that control of modern air traffic will be impossible without this. Now, we've moved into the jet age, away from the prop age. Now, are our airports adequately equipped with the proper instruments to make flying reasonably safe, even?
Yes, they are adequately equipped to make it reasonably safe. But we have to impose restrictions on the free flow of traffic because there's more traffic than the system can accept, and the public is subjected to inconvenience as a result of this. But we don't let the traffic flow uninterrupted and in an unsafe manner.
Mr. Hannafin.
Mr. Kisala, your primary responsibility is administration of the civil airspace. And as such, you even control the flights of the military. The Civil Aeronautics Board has to do, in this division of authority with things aeronautical in our country, primarily with the economics, the route certifications and mail pay. Are you attracted, sir, to the idea that the two functions of FAA and CAB should be combined in one single aviation entity and perhaps at the cabinet level discharge responsibility to this country?
Well, the British have developed such an organizational procedure, and it is working quite well. However, I have to say I have certain reservations over putting the economic implications into the same organization in which the safety function rests, because they might well be in conflict with each other and the public might suffer.
Well, sir, in the reorganization which resulted in the birth of the Federal Aviation Agency, some of the Civil Aeronautics Board's functions were transferred over to the FAA, specifically certain rulemaking functions. There is a kind of system of balances regarding your FAA authority with the CAB authority. Nevertheless, I think, sir, that it might be in the public interest that a vertical entity, which could not only deal very rapidly with economic matters, but very effectively and on an accelerated basis, when you have a situation such as this United TWA accident over Miller's Field. It's now been more than 2 weeks since that accident. There have been certain basic truths which have come out of the recorder, which was placed in that United jet. I think these should be in the public realm now. Do you agree?
Not completely. I think they should be in the public realm soon. I don't think we should wait months for them to become part of public knowledge. I think it should be very soon after the accident. And we shouldn't continue the process of taking 6 months to a year to determine probable cause. I don't think this is the public's interest.
Mr. Hackett.
General Quesada, it seems to me that the man in the middle in this whole situation is the poor traffic controller, who, after all, has to work with the equipment that you people give him. And he works for 8 hours. He has no lunch hour. He can't even leave his panel, generally speaking, during that period of time. It's not a very a job that I think you or I would like to spend 8 hours at during the day. Now, in 1958, I believe Congress ordered the FAA to make a study of air traffic control situations, that is to say, the hours, the working conditions, the pay, and various other things involved in that. Why hasn't that study either been made or reported to this point?
Well, first let me correct one point that you made. They don't work 8 hours without interruption. They don't work through their lunch hour, as you have suggested. They adopt normal working hours. However, I must say, the tasks of the air traffic controller are arduous, and it is certainly a tax on their nervous system. It requires detail beyond normal duties. Now, the reference that you made to a study was basically a study to provide for the assumption of the traffic control functions by the military establishment on our part, to absorb their function, and to provide a continuity of service in the event of emergency or war. And this has not been hard to do. We had a program all worked out, all developed, but when it was sent to the Department of Justice, we found that it was contrary to certain provisions of the Constitution, and we had to start all over again.
Well, now, haven't the traffic controllers begged you in the last couple of years to come up with two basic things, among others? One is a relatively easy-to-install computer system, and another is the business of a positive handoff, that is, between the control center and the tower, something that they feel was lacking, perhaps, in this New York situation. In other words, when the control of the plane left the control center and went to the airport tower, there was no positive indication from one radar panel to another. Now, haven't they been after you for some time to try to at least come up with those two things on an interim basis until you get your data processing controls all set?
Well, they have urged this, and we have urged it too. They work for us, you know. They are government employees, civil service employees. There are many centers with computers in them, IBM computers, as an example. However, they don't begin to meet the function as we are going to meet it in our semi-automatic system. I don't know exactly how many centers have IBM computers in them, but they have quite a few. There are quite a few. All of them haven't got it, but there are quite a few of them being used. This is not being neglected, I assure you.
Gentlemen, we have about 2.5 minutes. Mr. Wilson.
General Quesada, the number of near misses of airplanes in collision increasing. We've heard quite a good deal about those in the recently, but not in the recent past.
Now, I would say the number is decreasing. We're getting better reports than we used to, so it's kind of hard to measure this exactly. I feel that they are decreasing.
Well, what about the complaint of some pilots that they don't report near misses because they are required to undergo cross-examination by the Federal Aviation Agency and perhaps suffer a penalty themselves?
Well, of course they do. If they're involved in a near miss, they shouldn't be immune.
No, well, do you think the fact that you know of fewer near misses may be due to the fact that the pilots aren't reporting?
Well, if they are suppressing this information, it would be rather a pity. About 2 years ago, we had a period of some 20 months when we were giving immunity to the person who reported for statistical so we could accumulate statistics. But that was terminated about 2 years ago. We hope that the pilots are reporting near misses. I understand that they have an accumulation of data that they are suppressing. I hope they would give it to us.
You understand they have an accumulation of data they are suppressing
misses? Yes, I do.
So that there may be a lot more than you realize.
That may be so.
Mr. Spivak.
General, how many near misses do you think there were this year? Or do you know there were?
There were something like a little over 1,000 reported. And we haven't investigated each and every one reported.
And you think our system is very safe when there were almost 1,000 planes involved in near misses?
1,000 planes reported as near misses doesn't say that they were 1,000 near misses.
500 at least. 500 at least.
No, our data tells us that it is something less. There's a great tendency to report a near miss that is in fact not a near miss. The fact that the aircraft are separated by our rules by 1,000 feet, that in itself caused a lot of reports to be made that are near misses that in fact are not.
General, is it true or is it not true that there have been more accidents and more fatalities in the 2 years that you've been in charge than in the before, that there were more in 59 than more in 60?
It is not true. There have been more fatalities but less accidents.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Monitor's thanks to General E.R. Quesada, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Agency, and the members of the panel,